Escuelas Oficiales de Idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel intermedio B2. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Example. Trust is a confident relationship with the unknown. And the reason why I ended up with that definition, which took about 5 years to get to, confidence is really at the heart of trust.
One.
If you know the outcome of something, if there is no risk, you don't actually need trust. So what I was trying to pair it with is something unknown, the uncertainty piece. So it's this idea that we are placing our faith in someone or something or a system where you don't actually know the outcome and how it's going to work. When you think of it like that, it's like this alchemy of fears and hopes and desires. So it's got the high and the low. And that's what trust is made up of. It's this friction between these two things.
Two.
And at this point in time, huge shifts are happening in trust. People are less likely to trust institutions, for instance, than they used to be, but increasingly will trust their peers, but are also trusting people they don't know in real life. Businesses like Airbnb and Uber rely on people trusting strangers. On both sides, the customers and the service providers have to trust. And then the likes of TripAdvisor and Amazon that involve feedback from the general public. So on the one hand, you might trust what they have to say more than a business that wants to sell you something, but on the other hand, who are these people? Are they trustworthy?
Three.
How do we deduce who's trusty and who's not trusty and who's not even real?
So a fake review tends to be very descriptive, so very detailed, but detailed around fairly generic things. So like a fake hotel, they won't actually be able, if they've never been there, right? So they'll describe things that you would see in other hotels. Or they will get very detailed about the room. But the details that will be missing is sort of things like orientation and spatial conception and anything that's really about the experience of being there is very different from a real review.
Fourth.
Researchers at Cornell University also found that genuine reviewers use more nouns and punctuation, whereas deceivers use more verbs and long words.
But what they've found is that the language is so predictable in what people are using that artificial intelligence can pick up these fake reviews really better than humans, because there's language patterns, which I actually find reassuring that we now have the technology that they'll be able to weed out fake reviews.
Five.
We tend to be more discerning face-to-face than in digital environments. So digital environments, we tend to look at a few sort of trust signals, a few clues, and then make a decision. And often what we're making the decision around is that person familiar to us? And we base our trust on that. So it can be as simple, oh, they went to the same school as me, oh, they're from the same region as me, the same color of skin, same age. Like, so the signals, we respond very quickly to signals, which is what makes it quite fragile and even dangerous.
So you could put the same text with different visual cues and get a different response.
Yeah, whereas we tend to be slightly more discerning face to face.
Six.
What about things that aren't actually human?
I have a real issue with, well, the number of machines that are female. I don't know how it hasn't become a bigger topic. How do we accept this, though, that Viv, Cortana, Alexa, Tay, the bots, like the virtual assistant bots, they're all women? I find it awful when you watch young children, particularly, shouting at Alexa. They're shouting at a woman. And the reason why they've done this is they've proven this, that we tend to trust things with a female identity more than a male identity. So there's really interesting work coming out of MIT.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Example.
Trust is a confident relationship with the unknown. And the reason why I ended up with that definition, which took about 5 years to get to, confidence is really at the heart of trust.
One.
If you know the outcome of something, if there is no risk, you don't actually need trust. So what I was trying to pair it with is something unknown, the uncertainty piece. So it's this idea that we are placing our faith in someone or something or a system where you don't actually know the outcome and how it's going to work. When you think of it like that, it's like this alchemy of fears and hopes and desires. So it's got the high and the low. And that's what trust is made up of. It's this friction between these two things.
Two.
And at this point in time, huge shifts are happening in trust. People are less likely to trust institutions, for instance, than they used to be, but increasingly will trust their peers, but are also trusting people they don't know in real life. Businesses like Airbnb and Uber rely on people trusting strangers. On both sides, the customers and the service providers have to trust. And then the likes of TripAdvisor and Amazon that involve feedback from the general public. So on the one hand, you might trust what they have to say more than a business that wants to sell you something. But on the other hand, who are these people? Are they trustworthy?
Three.
How do we deduce who's trusty and who's not trusty and who's not even real?
So a fake review tends to be very descriptive, so very detailed, but detailed around fairly generic things. So like a fake hotel, they won't actually be able, if they've never been there, right? So they'll describe things that you would see in other hotels, or they will get very detailed about the room. But the details that will be missing is sort of things like orientation and spatial conception, and anything that's really about the experience of being there is very different from a real review.
Fourth.
Researchers at Cornell University also found that genuine reviewers use more nouns and punctuation, whereas deceivers use more verbs and long words.
But what they've found is that the language is so predictable in what people are using that artificial intelligence can pick up these fake reviews really better than humans, because there's language patterns, which I actually find reassuring that we now have the technology that they'll be able to weed out fake reviews.
Five.
We tend to be more discerning face-to-face than in digital environments. So digital environments, we tend to look at a few sort of trust signals, a few clues, and then make a decision. And often what we're making the decision around is that person familiar to us? And we base our trust on that. So it can be as simple, oh, they went to the same school as me, oh, they're from the same region as me, the same color of skin, same age. Like, so the signals, we respond very quickly to signals, which is what makes it quite fragile and even dangerous.
So you could put the same text with different visual cues and get a different response.
Yeah, whereas we tend to be slightly more discerning face to face.
Six.
What about things that aren't actually human?
I have a real issue with, well, the number of machines that are female. I don't know how it hasn't become a bigger topic. How do we accept this, though, that Viv, Cortana, Alexa, Tay, the bots, like the virtual assistant bots, they're all women? I find it awful when you watch young children, particularly, shouting at Alexa. They're shouting at a woman. And the reason why they've done this is they've proven this, that we tend to trust things with a female identity more than a male identity. So there's really interesting work coming out of MIT.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 1.
What's in the box? Whatever it is, it must be pretty important, because I've traveled with it, moved it from apartment to apartment to apartment. Sound familiar? Did you know that we Americans have about 3 times the amount of space we did 50 years ago? 3 times. So you'd think with all this extra space, we'd have plenty of room for all our stuff, right? Nope. There's a new industry in town, a $22 billion, 2.2 billion square foot industry, that of personal storage. So we've got triple the space, but we've become such good shoppers that we need even more space. So where does this lead? Lots of credit card debt, huge environmental footprints, and perhaps not coincidentally, our happiness levels flatline over the same 50 years.
Extract 2.
Well, I'm here to suggest there's a better way, that less might actually equal more. I bet most of us have experienced at some point the joys of less. College, in your dorm, traveling in a hotel room, camping where you got basically nothing, maybe a boat. Whatever it was for you, I bet that among other things, this gave you a little more freedom, a little more time. So I want to suggest that less stuff and less space are going to equal a smaller footprint. It's actually a great way to save you some money, and it's going to give you a little more ease in your life.
Extract 3.
So I started a project called Life Edited at lifeedited.org. So how can you live little? 3 main approaches. First of all, you need to edit ruthlessly. We've got to clear the arteries of our lives. That shirt that I haven't worn in years, it's time for me to let it go. We've got to cut the extraneous out of our lives, and we've got to learn to stem the inflow. We need to think before we buy. Ask ourselves, is that really going to make me happier? Truly? By all means, we should buy and own some great stuff. But we want stuff that we're going to love for years, not just stuff. Secondly, our new mantra, small is sexy. We want space efficiency. We want things that are designed for how they're used the vast majority of the time, not that rare event. Why have a 6-burner stove when you rarely use 3? So we want things that nest, we want things that stack, and we want to digitize. You can take paperwork, books, movies, and you can make it disappear. It's magic.
Extract 4.
Finally, we want multifunctional spaces and housewares. A sink combined with a toilet. A dining table becomes a bed. Same space. A little side table stretches out to seat 10. In the winning life edited scheme, in a render here, we combine a moving wall with transformer furniture to get a lot out of the space. Look at the coffee table. It grows in height and width to seat 10. My office folds away. Easily hidden. My bed just pops out of the wall, 2 fingers. Guests move the moving wall, have some fold-down guest beds. And of course, my own movie theater. So I'm not saying that we all need to live in 420 square feet, but consider the benefits of an edited life. Go from 3,000 to 2,000, from 1,500 to 1,000.
Dispone ahora de 1 minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 1.
What's in the box? Whatever it is, it must be pretty important, because I've traveled with it, moved it from apartment to apartment to apartment. Sound familiar? Did you know that we Americans have about 3 times the amount of space we did 50 years ago? 3 times. So you'd think with all this extra space, we'd have plenty of room for all our stuff, right? Nope. There's a new industry in town, a $22 billion, 2.2 billion square foot industry, that of personal storage. So we've got triple the space, but we've become such good shoppers that we need even more space. So where does this lead? Lots of credit card debt, huge environmental footprints, and perhaps not coincidentally, our happiness levels flatline over the same 50 years.
Extract 2.
Well, I'm here to suggest there's a better way, that less might actually equal more. I bet most of us have experienced at some point the joys of less. College, in your dorm, traveling in a hotel room, camping where you got basically nothing, maybe a boat. Whatever it was for you, I bet that among other things, this gave you a little more freedom, a little more time. So I want to suggest that less stuff and less space are going to equal smaller footprint. It's actually a great way to save you some money, and it's going to give you a little more ease in your life.
Extract 3.
So I started a project called Life Edited at lifeedited.org. So how can you live little? 3 main approaches. First of all, you need to edit ruthlessly. We've got to clear the arteries of our lives. That shirt that I haven't worn in years, it's time for me to let it go. We've got to cut the extraneous out of our lives, and we've got to learn to stem the inflow. We need to think before we buy. Ask ourselves, is that really going to make me happier? Truly? By all means, we should buy and own some great stuff. But we want stuff that we're going to love for years, not just stuff. Secondly, our new mantra, small is sexy. We want space efficiency. We want things that are designed for how they're used the vast majority of the time, not that rare event. Why have a 6-burner stove when you rarely use 3? So we want things that nest, we want things that stack, and we want to digitize. You can take paperwork, books, movies, and you can make it disappear. It's magic.
Extract 4.
Finally, we want multifunctional spaces and housewares. A sink combined with a toilet. A dining table becomes a bed. Same space. A little side table stretches out to seat 10. In the winning life-edited scheme, in a render here, we combine a moving wall with transformer furniture to get a lot out of the space. Look at the coffee table. It grows in height and width to seat 10. My office folds away, easily hidden. My bed just pops out of the wall, 2 fingers. Guests move the moving wall, have some fold-down guest beds. And of course, my own movie theater. So I'm not saying that we all need to live in 420 square feet, but consider the benefits of an edited life. Go from 3,000 to 2,000, from 1,500 to 1,000.
Dispone ahora de 1 minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
The first movie that I remember seeing was The Little Mermaid. And my parents still tell me stories about going to see that movie with me, and I think I was 3 years old at the time. And on the way home from seeing that movie in the theaters, I was in the car in the back seat singing the words to the songs that I'd heard in the movie. And they kind of looked at each other and were really confused as to how I was remembering the words after seeing the movie only once. The first song that made me fall in love with country music was Blue by Leanne Rimes. That song just completely resonated with me, and I think what resonated with me even more was that she was young and she was doing these things that I could only dream about doing. All the things that I would daydream about in my bedroom, she was up there doing, and she was 14 years old, and I thought there was something so just motivating about that. At some point when I was about 10 years old, I was watching TV and I was watching a special about Faith Hill. It talked about how she went to Nashville. That's the moment that I realized that Nashville is where you need to be if you want to sing country music. And so every day I would beg my parents just obnoxiously, nonstop, we need to go to Nashville, please just let's take a trip to Nashville. I just want to go to Nashville so bad on spring break, can we go to Nashville? And eventually, when I was 11 years old, we took my first trip to Nashville. We had heard about this place called Music Row, which is where all the record labels are. And we drove up and down Music Row, and I had this little demo CD of me singing karaoke music. And my mom would pull up outside one of the record labels, and I would run in and talk to the receptionist and say, "Hi, I'm Taylor. I'm 11. I want a record deal. Call me." I grew up in Pennsylvania, and growing up in Pennsylvania and wanting to pursue country music, those are two different things. I remember, you know, when I went through this period of time when I didn't really have that many friends at school, kids would just heckle me and be like, "Oh, go sing that country beep." And then at that point, it just dawned on me that I had to love being different or else I was just going to end up being dark and angry. I definitely was more nervous walking into my first day of my freshman year of high school than I was walking up to record labels and handing them my CD. I just was so much more comfortable playing a show in front of thousands of people or sitting in a conference room with music industry executives than I was playing at my high school talent show. When I write songs, I don't hesitate to put names in the songs because that's how I deal with life, you know? It's funny because people that had no idea that I had a crush on them or was interested in them usually won't find out through me telling them, but they will find out when they hear their name in one of my songs. Because I don't ever confess that sort of thing in real life, but I really do like to confess it in this fantasy music life that I get to live. So I wrote this song called Hey Steven, and I sent Steven a text message, and I was like, hey, track 5. When I am getting up in front of an award show room full of people that I really respect, I always just kind of get butterflies in my stomach and my legs start to kind of shake a little bit, and I'm just like, don't mess up, don't mess up, don't mess up. But most of the time, like when I'm going out on stage and it's an arena or a stadium even, that's the most fun that I ever, ever have, is when I'm in that moment. I have never been more motivated by anything than I am by the sound of screaming people. That's my favorite sound in the world, and it can get me to do anything.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
The first movie that I remember seeing was The Little Mermaid. And my parents still tell me stories about going to see that movie with me, and I think I was 3 years old at the time. And on the way home from seeing that movie in the theaters, I was in the car in the back seat singing the words to the songs that I'd heard in the movie. And they kind of looked at each other and were really confused as to how I was remembering the words after seeing the movie only once. The first song that made me fall in love with country music was Blue by Leanne Rimes. That song just completely resonated with me, and I think what resonated with me even more was that she was young and she was doing these things that I could only dream about doing. All the things that I would daydream about in my bedroom, she was up there doing, and she was 14 years old, and I thought there was something so just motivating about that. At some point when I was about 10 years old, I was watching TV, and I was watching a special about Faith Hill. It talked about how she went to Nashville. That's the moment that I realized that Nashville is where you need to be if you want to sing country music. And so every day I would beg my parents just obnoxiously, nonstop, we need to go to Nashville, please just let's take a trip to Nashville. I just want to go to Nashville so bad on spring break. Can we go to Nashville? And eventually when I was 11 years old, we took my first trip to Nashville. We had heard about this place called Music Row, which is where all the record labels are. And we drove up and down Music Row, and I had this little demo CD of me singing karaoke music. And my mom would pull up outside one of the record labels, and I would run in and talk to the receptionist and say, "Hi, I'm Taylor. I'm 11. I want a record deal. Call me." I grew up in Pennsylvania, and growing up in Pennsylvania and wanting to pursue country music, those are two different things. I remember, you know, when I went through this period of time when I didn't really have that many friends at school, kids would just heckle me and be like, "Oh, go sing that country beep." And then at that point, it just dawned on me that I had to love being different, or else I was just going to end up being dark and angry. I definitely was more nervous walking into my first day of my freshman year of high school than I was walking up to record labels and handing them my CD. I just was so much more comfortable playing a show in front of thousands of people or sitting in a conference room with music industry executives than I was playing at my high school talent show. When I write songs, I don't hesitate to put names in the songs because that's how I deal with life, you know? It's funny because people that had no idea that I had a crush on them or was interested in them usually won't find out through me telling them, but they will find out when they hear their name in one of my songs. Because I don't ever confess that sort of thing in real life, but I really do like to confess it in this fantasy music life that I get to live. So I wrote this song called Hey Steven, and I sent Steven a text message, and I was like, "Hey, track 5. When I am getting up in front of an award show room full of people that I really respect, I always just kind of get butterflies in my stomach and my legs start to kind of shake a little bit, and I'm just like, "Don't mess up, don't mess up, don't mess up." But most of the time, like when I'm going out on stage and it's an arena or a stadium even, that's the most fun that I ever have, is when I'm in that moment. I have never been more motivated by anything than I am by the sound of screaming people. That's my favorite sound in the world, and it can get me to do anything.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.